Welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged Podcast, a podcast that is deeply committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. And today will be, I say this every time, probably should mix this up a little bit, but I'll just say it. Today is no exception. I mean, in fact, today may be one of the most important podcasts you've ever listened to, period. It's based on a book called Stockholm Syndrome Christianity. And when I was thinking about this just before I walked into the studio, I thought about something that I memorized a long time ago. It's Paul's farewell address to the Ephesians, where he says, "In the presence of God and of Christ Jesus, who will come to judge the living and the dead, and in view of his appearing kingdom, I give you this charge. Preach the word. Be prepared in season and out of season." And then something else he said is, "And now compelled by the Spirit," this is in Acts chapter 20, I think, "and now compelled by the Spirit, I'm going to Jerusalem not knowing what will happen to me there. I only know that in every city the Holy Spirit warns me that prison and hardship are facing me. However, I consider my life worth nothing to me, if only I may finish the race and complete the task the Lord Jesus Christ has given to me, the task of testifying to the gospel of God's grace. Now I know that none of you among whom I have gone about preaching the kingdom will ever see me again. Therefore, I testify to you that I'm innocent of the blood of all men, because I have not hesitated to preach the full counsel of God." And then he said, "Take care of yourselves and all the flock of which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. Be shepherds of the church of God, which he purchased with his own blood. For I know that after I leave, savage wolves will come in among you and will not spare the flock. Even from among your own number, men will arise and distort the truth in order to draw away disciples after themselves. So be on your guard. Remember that for 3 years, I never stopped warning each one of you, night and day, with tears." And I think this book, Stockholm Syndrome Christianity, is a warning to the body of Christ. It's a warning not to capitulate to the culture, but to transform the culture. Anyway, with that, let me introduce our guest. His name is Dr. John West. He's vice president and senior fellow of the Discovery Institute in Seattle. I love Seattle. He serves as managing director of the Institute's Center for Science and Culture. And by the way, he co-founded that center with philosopher of science Stephen Meyer, who we love, way back in 1996. His current research examines the impact of science and scientism on public policy and culture. His other areas of expertise include constitutional law, American government and institutions, and religion and politics. John West holds a PhD in government from Claremont Graduate University, and was previously an associate professor of political science at Seattle Pacific University, which is a university that we're going to talk about some in this podcast. And at that university, he chaired the Department of Political Science and Geography, and he has directed a dozen documentaries. He's written or edited some 13 books, including the book we're going to be talking about today, his most recent book, Stockholm Syndrome Christianity, and the subtitle's important, Why America's Christian Leaders Are Failing and What We Can Do About It. John, it is an honor to have you on the Hank Unplugged Podcast.
Oh, Hank, it's an honor for me to be on. I mean, the work of Christian Research Institute from the days of Walter Martin when I was growing up to your wise stewardship, I mean, it's one of the lights, I'd say, in American culture and American Christianity, of really giving wise discernment. And you've had an influence for decades. And so it's a real privilege to join you.
Well, thank you, John. And I hope this is a book every single podcast listener will get. And I say this from the bottom of my heart. I think it's a very important and timely book. It's called Stockholm Syndrome Christianity. And if you're watching this, as opposed to just listening to this, you can see the cover. And that's the very first thing I want to ask you about, John, is the cover, because it really is descriptive of what the content of this book is all about.
Yeah, so it just stuck with me, this imagery of wolves and sheep, but a little bit different than what people might be expecting. So the idea is that the sheep, if you see in the picture, are surrounding the wolf like he's their friend. And so you have the wolf in the fold, you're doing bad things, but the Stockholm Syndrome Christians really, I think, are the sheep who are misled and actually think that the wolf is someone that they can identify with, when in fact the wolf really wants to eat them up.
So we've sort of defined what Stockholm Syndrome Christianity is. And you say that most Christians in America grow up in cultural captivity. They're immersed in a cultural battle to genuine Christianity. So they take on the trappings of the culture as opposed to transforming the culture.
Yeah, and I, you know, when I was thinking about this and praying about it, this image came for me. You know, some people may know a little bit about the history of the Stockholm Syndrome. This was this infamous bank robbery in the 1970s in Stockholm, Sweden, where a bunch of bank workers were taken hostage. But the strange thing that happened was after that experience, many of those hostages had grateful feelings toward their hostage takers, toward the criminals. And so some psychologists, in psychology, it's quite controversial, so I'm not claiming that good or bad, but this insight that sometimes when you're in this stressful situation or held captive or in an abusive situation, that one strategy that some people adopt is they end up adopting the point of view of their captors. For me, that really hit home to the people that who I knew as when I was at a Christian college and in my work at Discovery, where I've seen people go off the rails. They basically are adopting the point of view of their cultural captors. And I think that, you know, these people, in some sense, are personally sincere, but again, their worldview is becoming indistinguishable from the secular elites that they really should be a missionary too. You know, we're called to be salt and light. So we should be representing truth to the secular world. But in many cases, these Stockholm Syndrome Christians are becoming missionaries for the secular elites to their fellow Christians.
Yeah. And you in the book cite a university that you were an associate professor at, Seattle Pacific University, as sort of a microcosm of what this book is all about.
Yeah. So, as many people and probably many of your listeners know, universities in America, when they got started, like Harvard, Princeton, Yale, were devoutly Christian institutions, many devoutly even evangelistic. But then by the 19th century, many of them had started to fall away. And so, evangelical Christians started a whole new slew of Christian universities in the mid to late 19th century to sort of uphold the faith. And many of those have done great work over the years. But what I experienced at my university, and I think is in microcosm what's happening elsewhere in the last couple of decades, particularly, really they're falling in the same direction, you know, kowtowing to the secular elites. And so what I saw at my institution is, in a way, we're kind of sad because the more intentional we got about Christianity in our marketing to parents, because that was sort of the marketing niche, the less it actually reflected in the classroom. So at the same time we were marketing Christian, 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 we were hiring people who were further from orthodoxy. You know, students were getting heartbroken. I mean, I had students come in, you know, seeking counsel from their religion classes where they were being taught that open theism, the idea that God himself doesn't know the future. And as a political scientist, I was giving them resources for more orthodox things that they weren't being assigned. So it wasn't just that they were being exposed to false ideas like God doesn't know the future. It was they were only being exposed to that view. They weren't being given the orthodox, you know, responses. And so I saw just how devastating this was in students' lives. And that was hard. And then, you know, on a lot of other issues, it began to, you know, they began to hire again people. When I came there, actually, this sort of summarizes my experience and summarizes the problem of why institutions like that slide. So when I came to Seattle Pacific, I was warned by some fellow faculty members, oh, we have a really theologically conservative board of trustees. They just denied tenure to someone in the, you know, school of theology because they were, you know, regarded as heterodox. And they were saying, you know, to warn me. But little did they know, in my heart, I was saying, great, you actually have a board who's upholding the mission of the institution. That's the number one thing a board of a Christian institution or a board of a church should do, safeguard the mission. But then fast forward 12 years when I decided to leave. I had tenure, I didn't have to leave, but I sort of saw the writing on the wall and I didn't want to be an institution that was going in a trajectory, further and further away from the faith. But when I left, one of my last battles, which is try to defend a faculty member who had been hired and basically was being got rid of and denied tenure because he was too theologically and also politically conservative. So he had alienated people, even though students loved him. He was a vibrant Christian. I think he was one of the best hires in the years I was there. And then at that point, the board didn't protect him. So we went from a board actually upholding the standards of the faith to 12 years hence, basically allowing the increasingly woke faculty and administrators to do whatever they wanted. And that emasculation of the board, where the board was convinced to defer everything to the faculty and staff, because the board isn't an expert. So just trust the faculty and staff and don't exercise oversight. That was the downfall of the institution, in my view.
Yeah, and maybe this is a little off point, but I think the fact that you were a professor at a professed Christian university highlights the reality that parents have to be very careful about where they send their children. In fact, you have a guideline that helps people when they're trying to determine where they're going to send their children to university.
Yeah, so this is, I do have a heart for this because I saw parents and children mortgage their future going into tens of thousands of dollars of debt solely because they thought they were going to integrate, their faith with their learning, which is a great idea. But in fact, the opposite was happening. And so, they were basically sending, I mean, one other example while I was there, it was just tragic. A student who actually wrote something for the student newspaper about how by the time they got through the theology classes, how their faith was almost destroyed because they were taught that the Bible really isn't historically accurate. They were taught, all sorts of things that they shouldn't be paying attention to. This was from an avowedly evangelical Christian institution. And so I do think that parents need to be very careful. In some cases, it's actually maybe better to send your kids to a secular school that has some devout Christian ministries on there than to send them to an quote unquote Christian university where, the walk and the talk are different. And so, but there are ways you can find out. I mean, even at my institution, if you knew the questions to ask, you would determine pretty carefully. And so actually on my website, johngwest.com, I have a free sort of series of 10 questions parents can ask when evaluating a Christian college. And just one example, it's hard to know exactly what's happening in the classroom, but in most Christian institutions, their chapel program, whether it's required or not, those things now post-COVID are posted online. And so you can get an idea of, well, what speakers are they bringing to chapel? Are they bringing speakers who say defend a pro-life stance or biblical sexuality or the historical truth and integrity of the Bible? Or are they not? I mean, if they're going with increasingly woke speakers or speakers who aren't really getting at the culture pressure points that are on Christianity today, that is a big warning sign because that's who they're valuing, who they're bringing to campus. And then, there are a lot of other, questions. A lot of even Christian colleges have campus health centers. Well, do they refer people to Planned Parenthood in those campus health centers? In their theology schools, how many are members of the Evangelical Theological Society, which has a statement on biblical inerrancy? At our school, they boasted that they didn't have any members of the Evangelical Theological Society because they would have had to affirm biblical inerrancy. Now, we may talk later about some of the challenges, even in ETS, because definitions of trying to redefine inerrancy. But I mean, when you have people boasting that they won't even join because they don't even want to say that they believe the Bible is inerrant, then I think that's a warning sign. So there are lots of key questions that you can ask recruiters to really glean some things about those institutions. But I do, if you have a passion for your kids and you want them to get a good Christian education, that's an honorable and great thing. But don't think that what the PR for the school is the same. Like I said, in the 12 years I was at Seattle Pacific, they did a marketing study that made their marketing more intentionally Christian, while what was happening in the classroom was going in the other direction.
Yeah, wow. And you mentioned this a few times in your comments just now. There's a dismissive view of the Bible, and I think it really begins with that.
I agree. And so chapter one of my book is about that. You know, it's called Merely Human, because that everything else, whether you talk about sex, race, religious liberty, science, it all flows, you know, a lot of errors from first you surrender the Bible. And I don't think that people are sufficiently aware of just how much that is happening. And we can talk some specifics. And that's, by the way, what made my book controversial. You know, this was ultimately published by Discovery Institute Press. I had an agent who was really well connected, who sold lots of books and got some interest, but they regarded it as too hot to handle. There was one publisher that I'm not going to mention that was very interested, but I had to give a list of everyone who I critiqued in the book. And when they saw, especially one name, Andy Stanley, that killed the book. They weren't allowed to publish a book that criticized him.
It's so interesting because I published my first book in 1993, and it was called Christianity in Crisis, and I overtly named names in that book. Because if you go through the Bible, you know that this is a pattern. I mean, St. Paul certainly did it. And it's not gratuitous. It's not to be mean. But there's a purpose for naming names if it's done in the right way and in the right context and with solid evidence, as you do in your book. You just mentioned Andy Stanley. Andy Stanley very clearly has said that the Old Testament is an obsolete testament. And he said much, much more in this regard. So it's not just a flippant statement that could be taken out of context. In context, he disparages the Old Testament as a testament that is detrimental to anyone's Christian faith. I mean, the statements are mind-blowing.
It is. And, you know, there was a kerfuffle when he gave some lectures based off of that. And, you know, people were saying, oh, things were taken out of context. So I don't deal with some of his public statements. I deal with the book he wrote, Irresistible, where he gives his fullest explanation of this view. And you're exactly right. He not only calls it the obsolete testament, he says that we should reorder our Bible so it's put to the back of the Bible. He basically blames everything bad, including, get this, anti-Semitism, on Christians believing in the Old Testament. So in some strange way, some perverse way, he's actually blaming, you know, Jews for their own persecution, because it's Christians believing in the vengeful God of the Old Testament is leading to, you know, Jewish anti-Semitism. I mean, it is a really, and this is not how a spirit-filled or, you know, Orthodox pastor should talk about God's holy word. And so that whole book is dismissive. And just to be clear, you know, obviously Christians, you know, have always regarded, we don't believe in the Old Testament in quite the same way as Jews do, because we think Jesus fulfilled like the sacrificial system. So Christians have always understood that. That's not what Andy Stanley is arguing. Andy Stanley, as you point out, calls the whole thing obsolete, says, you know, we should just, and he also says actually in that book that the Bible is no longer defensible in public. And so he cedes so much ground. And this is a minister, you know, Andy Stanley. I was ordained as an elder in a Presbyterian denomination. Andy Stanley is Baptist, but I was instructed as a Presbyterian elder, we were given some of Andy Stanley's books because he prides himself as being a leader among leaders who is mentoring a whole new generation of pastors around the world. So I agree, you know, I don't try to be gratuitous in this book. And, you know, there are a number of things that I share where I don't name people because they're not public figures, but it's still important insight. But with public figures, public teachers, like Andy Stanley, I think it is important to name names, or else people will be, you know, not on guard and they won't realize what's happening. And so, yeah. Andy Stanley is really bad news. And I start with his view of the Bible. I'm so glad that you highlighted his views on the Bible, because more recently, some of his defenders have gotten squeamish because, you know, he's also been very squishy, if worse than squishy, on same-sex marriage and things, which is important. But his views of the Bible and biblical authority on the Old Testament, or the lack thereof, predate those things. And so that's the other thing, is things don't stay the same. Once you start conceding ground and bashing the Bible in some areas, I mean, you're basically on the wrong road. And you can actually see that in Andy Stanley. It didn't just stay with the Old Testament.
You know, John, I wonder when we're talking about this subject, and we talked about this in-house when we were going through your book, just wondering how someone can say the things that he says. I'm talking about specific statements which you cite in your book. How they can say that if you ever have read through the Bible comprehensively. In other words, if you have some sense of how the testaments fit together, how you have the types and shadows in the Old Testament fulfilled in the New Testament, you know, it's a congruent whole. It's a pattern that you can't disrupt. You can't try to dissect improperly. It seems to me that someone like Andy Stanley, whose father was a famous preacher as well, it seems like he would have some kind of understanding of the scripture. And therefore, the question comes to mind, is he doing this gratuitously or does he just not know any better? Are people biblically illiterate in the pulpit to that extent?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I can't presume to get into his heart, but I do think, I mean, he has to know some of this. And I actually think I've seen sometimes when he's pressed personally, he'll bob and weave and say, oh, well, yes, I accept that. But then he goes right and preaches what he's been doing. And so I think actually he is a good example of a Stockholm Syndrome Christian in this way, is that when he says and I think this is also how he defends it to himself, when he says the Bible is no longer defensible in public, he has so imbibed the secular critiques. I mean, we also see this where he's not willing to defend, you know, in one part of the book, basically, oh, you know, the archaeologists say that Jericho never fell in the way that the Bible says. Well, that's actually not true. But and he has this list, or that the Exodus didn't really take place. Now, he then goes and says, oh, but actually there is some evidence, but he doesn't go into it. But I do think what this shows is that he really has imbibed the secular critiques really deeply. And so he's fearful. He does believe in Jesus, but he's fearful that the secular critiques are true. And so he just cedes ground and he thinks that, well, and those aren't, so he's not willing to defend those things as important because in some sense, his own belief system has been made insecure. And so he's really viewing things from the standpoint of, you know, a secular non-Christian. And that's not helpful. Now, I think to himself, he probably says, well, that helps me, you know, reach out to people who aren't Christians. Well, but what are you reaching out to them with? I mean, at the end of the day, if you strip away all the things he's stripping away, there's not that much left. And you're not really, you know, the Christian message that's transforming is the true Christian message that goes, you know, in the entire Bible. And so if you cut off large parts of it, you're not going to talk about it, or you don't think are defensible, or you then you're depriving it of its power, because its truth is power. But if you muzzle it, I mean, what's left? So I think Andy is a really sad, sad case, but also a case of how he is at a historically evangelical church that he founded. He has a board of elders he's supposed to be accountable to. And, you know, 10, 15 years ago, he wasn't as heterodox as he is today. So presumably, at least some of his elders should be troubled by some of this. And so where are they? And I do think one of the messages of my book, this is both with regard to Seattle Pacific University with its board, but also Andy Stanley's church. I went to his website and look, they have a board of elders. He's supposed to be accountable to it. What are they doing? And so it's not just the heterodox people like Andy Stanley, it's the people surrounding him who are making it possible for him to have that platform and who are not calling him to account. You know, I'm not a member of his church, so I don't have any authority over him. All I could do is talk about, you know, what he says and sort of show that this isn't really what the Bible says. But you have elders in his church. What are they doing?
What do you say to the person that says, John, I appreciate what you're saying, but why do you have to name names? Why can't you talk about this conceptually without actually naming the name Andy Stanley? I mean, this is a rhetorical question on my part, because I think you've done exactly the right thing.
Well, I think one reason we're at the situation we are at today is because increasingly a lot of mainstream evangelical Christian publishers don't want books that name names. And for a variety of reasons, some may be economic. I mean, Andy Stanley is a big economic figure for, you know, places he publishes for and does stuff. But here's the challenge. if you're just generic, then people aren't going to see where the problem really lies, and they're not going to be, you know, as discerning. And I bring people back, and some of your listeners should certainly know this. In the 1970s, there was a battle for the Bible, and there were a lot of, I mean, the Southern Baptist Convention back then was not the Southern Baptist Convention as today, and I understand there are a lot of issues going on with the Southern Baptist Convention today. But you had evangelicals who were also bailing on the Bible. And the way we got around that was not simply by people tiptoeing around it. We had people like, whether it be Harold Lincell, actually Walter Martin, other people who named names and gave evidence, not in a gratuitous fashion, not in an unloving fashion, but that's what warned people and got them thinking. And then out of that, I think something good came out of it. Francis Schaeffer, who I actually dedicate the book to, was another person who lovingly was willing to name some names and give examples. And that's out of which I'd say a genuine sort of mini revival, if you would, happen. But if you make it so generic that people can't really tell what you're talking about, I don't think that's enough for really applicability. And again, I could just go public people. Here's the other thing is if you're a public teacher of the Bible, it comes with the territory. I mean, look at the Bereans in the Bible. You know, when the apostles brought the message, what did they do? They compared it to the Bible and discussed it openly. They didn't. And so if you're, and that's the difference that I made, you know, one of the key differences of the stories I shared that were just personal level versus those that I named publicly were, you know, are they a public figure making these arguments out there? Well, then they need to be held publicly accountable. And in fact, in many cases, if they're not, there's no chance of addressing the error because it goes on and they end up misleading people and there's never any accountability.
Yeah, it goes back to what I quoted earlier, watch over the flock of which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers, be shepherds of the church of God, which he purchased with his own blood. For I know that after I leave, savage wolves will come in among you and will not spare the flock. And then he says, even from among your own numbers, men will arise and distort the truth. And we're talking about people who are considered evangelical mainstream Christians who are clearly distorting truth. One of the people you cite as a case study is Robert Gundry, Westmont.
Yeah. So, you know, this was a time in the 70s and 80s where this battle for the Bible was taking place. And Robert Gundry, Westmont is still identified as an evangelical institution, but he came out with a commentary on Matthew that basically adopts the and baptizes the higher criticism, you know, liberal progressive theology of the 19th century. And so, for example, the infancy narratives in place like Matthew, well, that was made up by the author, you know, with albeit commendable reasons to make his theological point. But, you know, I recall correctly, he said, you know, you had the shepherds in Luke, and then that was transformed, rewritten as the wise men in Matthew. And then who really knows what the real history was, you know, get between that. And so it was, but that's also a glimpse into why we're having a problem now. When Gundry published that, you had enough high-powered people, you know, obviously Norm Geisler was one, who were willing to raise and press the issue and say, this is not good. I mean, this is not an evangelical or even, I'd say, historically Catholic or Eastern Orthodox view of the Bible. And this is, you know, this is really baptizing theological liberalism, and there really isn't good grounding for it, let alone, you know, it's just not good teaching, but there's not good grounding for it. And so you had that pushback. And so, and that was salutary because it, I think, you know, really encouraged a lot of more biblically faithful Christians to counter that positively with better teaching. Sadly, Gundry, and this is an indictment of the Christian colleges, you know, he was a chair at Westmont, and he probably taught thousands of students with his views that were really devaluing the importance of the Bible or the truth of the historical accuracy of the Bible. And so he wasn't removed. And I think that is that then you get the next generation from Gundry. You know, Gundry, actually, someone pointed out to me that later in life, Gundry actually wrote a book sort of lamenting the theological liberalism that was coming in. I don't know how he reconciled that with he really set the groundwork for that. But again, there was a good salutary pushback. But today, let's fast forward to today. And, you know, I know and this is controversial. I had other people who really were not pleased that I dealt with this. And the person who can't be criticized today is a guy named Mike Lacona at Houston Christian University, who has done some good work on the resurrection. I accept that he's a, you know, has a personal faith in Christ. But what he's preaching, what he's calling flexible inerrancy, not only is not inerrancy, it's not even a traditional view of Christians who say don't may not believe the scripture inerrant, but do think that the teaching is infallible. I mean, it's nowhere near. And let's, you know, I like to get details, because to me, that's where the rubber meets the road. And so, you know, at the surface, he says, oh, I trust the Bible. You know, I'm defending its authority. But look at what he's actually doing. And one thing that I think stands out is when he talks about how, you know, Jesus in some of the synoptic gospels is given at the time of his death on the cross, where he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Which is, of course, a quote from Psalm 22, this dramatic prophetic psalm about what, you know, Jesus experienced on the cross. Mike Lacona says, well, okay, but John says, Jesus said, I thirst. Now, there's no incompatibility between that. I mean, giving different details. So there's no problem to solve there. I mean, there's not a problem. I mean, it's just not. But what does Lacona say? Well, he says, well, actually, I thirst was John's paraphrase of my God, why have you forsaken me? Well, I would bet, I'm not a betting man, but I would bet if we brought in 1,000 people and gave them paraphrase, my God, why have you forsaken me, that none of them would come up with, I thirst. I mean, that's not a paraphrase. I mean, that's a wholesale reinvention. If your view of inerrancy thinks that it is, and yes, they didn't have tape recorders, no one says that, but that rewriting, my God, why have you forsaken me as I thirst, if you somehow think that that has a smidge of accuracy, or that your view of inerrancy sort of justifies that, I mean, I guess I have some swamp land in Florida to sell you, because, I mean, that is just dramatic. That's not inerrancy. That's not infallibility. That's not the historic Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, or Protestant view of biblical authority. But that's his view. And it goes on. You know, he basically says that the Gospels are like, should be regarded at like Hollywood movies that are inspired by true events. But then you take liberties, you create new situations, you create new, you know, plot lines, new details, you create new words and messages. I mean, so you're basically saying it really isn't authoritative. So he says, well, I'm defending a new type of, you know, inerrancy. But if you actually get to the specifics of what he's doing, he's not. And here's why it's so corrosive is very, very, very few people are calling Mike Lacona out. He is still a member in good standing of the Evangelical Theological Society, which says that it endorses as a non-negotiable biblical inerrancy. And I know people, I mean, I don't want to get too much into this, but I know there are backdoors campaigns where people are really criticized and try to shut down. And Lacona himself tries to shut people down behind the scenes. Because I've seen that in one case that I'm personally aware of that I'm not going to talk more about. But so there's this effort to not give it the light of day or open discussion. And I want to say that's a manipulation tactic. Whatever Lacona thinks he's doing, the shutting down of actual criticism or the inability to respond to serious criticism by like Lydia McGrew or others, is a manipulation tactic to try to win the debate by ensuring there is no debate. And that's just really unfortunate. And it's going to be damaging, because if you have the view, really, what Lacona is preaching is pretty much it's garden variety, 19th century, early 20th century theological liberalism. He's basically, you know, the Bible is so human that, you know, really it's not God's, you know, direct authoritative word. It's humans come up with it. I mean, here's another example. He suggests that when Jesus in John talks about the coming of the Holy Spirit, that, well, that happened before Pentecost. So John was sort of interpolating that from, you know, something later into the words of Jesus. I mean, this is not how serious Christians for the last 2,000 years have treated the Bible. And let's be clear, it's not like, yes, there are a few very small handful, I would say, of issues. I wouldn't call them contradictions, but some things that need to be explained that are on minor matters. That's not what he's dealing with. he's creating, you know, things where there is no problem, where, you know, people are sharing different aspects of things that are both true, and he's basically devaluing their truth. And I'm really actually concerned about Lacona so much because there's been this almost conspiracy of silence not to talk about or to criticize it. And so he's has a platform, though, to teach, you know, a whole new generation of people. And this is bad news.
Yeah, the Synoptic Gospels, and we've been talking about this for years on the Bible Instagram broadcast. I mean, they provide complementary details. And you cited an example of that. And I think Michael should most certainly know that. Your second chapter is titled Secular Science, and I found this to be a very important chapter. In fact, you cite Francis Collins as the quintessential example of a Stockholm Syndrome Christian who diminishes the role of God in creation. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, and this was now sort of post-COVID controversies. Collins is less a star, a little more controversial. But I will say that when we at Discovery Institute began interacting with him or following him, it was like any criticism was regarded as verboten. And I experienced this actually some of myself. But the issue is, it's not his personality. And just to be clear, I'm not questioning his personal attachment to Jesus. And he has an inspiring, you know, story of how he was an atheist, agnostic, and then, you know, then came to Christ. But again, he's a public figure, and he has public teachings and also public actions in government, which we can get to. And I think those are things to, you know, fair game. And like Mike Lacona, I think Francis Collins, in the area of God as creator, tried to get his way by discouraging debate and by deplatforming, if you will, people who disagreed with him. So Collins promotes this view of theistic, or I would say deistic, evolution, where he tries to baptize Darwin, and not just Darwin as common ancestry, which I think is problematic too, but even more generally, if you read his book, The Language of God, which got, you know, was a bestseller, and loads of Christians, and I think loads of Christian pastors who should have known better, I think some of them didn't actually read the book, praised. He basically argues that, you know, either God didn't direct specifically, and he uses the example of junk DNA, which many of your listeners may now know has now been exploded scientifically. I mean, it's not good science, but at the time, this was the idea that, you know, most of our DNA doesn't code for proteins. And if it doesn't code for proteins, it's of no use to Darwinian evolution to build new things to that, those chance mutations. And so it must be junk. And the argument was by Collins, well, God wouldn't have done, you know, if God did that, he wouldn't have loaded our system with junk DNA. You know, that would have been a lousy creator. So it must have been through this process of Darwinian evolution, because that's a messy process and we could expect lots of junk and happenstance. That was part of his argument in this book. Now, he had one other alternative. So you either believe that the history of life was, you know, done by Darwinian evolution because it was and involved, in a way, happenstance and things because of, you know, the random mutations, because we're filled with junk DNA. Or he said, well, maybe you could believe, you know, if you're a Christian, he doesn't say he did, but he said, you know, you could believe that maybe God did actually direct things, maybe didn't just leave it to the unguided process of evolution. Maybe God did direct things, but then he made life look like it was the product of a blind and purposeless process. So your two options are either, you know, our development really was, in some sense, you know, a Darwinian process that really didn't have us in view, or that maybe God did know from eternity and did direct, but he made it look like it was blind and undirected. And I have to say, this is a real mind bender. Some of your listeners will know Richard Dawkins, the arch atheist Darwinist. Even he started one of his books saying, biology is the study of things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Now, he goes on to say, well, through science and stuff, we know that, you know, the real truth is that it wasn't. But he actually does say that the actual, when you look at biology, it looks designed, you know, for a purpose. And but here you have the leading evangelical Christian scientist toasted on the cover of Time magazine saying, oh, no. God made it look like it was random and directed. But, well, you know, we know through the subjective eyes of faith that maybe God, you know, God directed it, but he made it look random and undirected. This is really screwy. And it's not based on evidence. I mean, that's the other thing. If you actually, and I do this a little bit in my book, and certainly my colleagues have done it, even more. But this is not driven by evidence, because the evidence doesn't show this. This is driven by a desire to be accepted. And also, in some degree, I think, you know, that Collins, as a Stockholm Syndrome Christian, has bought into the surrounding secularist mindset, and so didn't want to delve too deeply into the evidence on the other side. Because the evidence that he offers, like criticizing Michael Behe on irreducible complexity and stuff, he offers rehashed arguments that don't actually pan out. But here's why this matters. It's not just his view. He went on a crusade to spread this view to other Christian leaders, and then by default to all evangelical Christians. So I write about in the book that there's this actually meeting at the Bush number two White House between him, speechwriter Michael Gerson, and a guy named Pete Wenner, who were commiserating about, they were embarrassed that so many Christians still were critical of Darwin. And so how do they surmount that embarrassment? Well, they have to convince them of the truth of Darwinian evolution. And so what did Collins do? He got millions of dollars from the Templeton Foundation to basically start a project specifically designed to convince evangelical Christian leaders to embrace Darwin. And he did it in the name of dialogue. Okay, that's fine to have dialogue, but he actually didn't want dialogue. What he did was hold these private confabs that would bring, say, leaders from Christianity Today, Reformed Theological Seminary, I mean, you name it, leading evangelicals, to privately only hear from people who were going to defend Darwinian evolution. They wouldn't bring anyone on the other side. They wouldn't bring Steve Meyer or Michael Behe or Bill Dembski or, you know, any of the number of other, you know, Christian thinkers who had critiques of Darwin. And the message of these meetings was, science overwhelmingly baptizes Darwin, therefore your only goal as theologians is to baptize that and figure a way to make it work. No one asked the first question was, well, is Darwinism actually true or not? And Collins has spent a lifetime, some people saw this during COVID, but this was even in the debate over design and Darwin, it was similar. Collins tried to win the debate by preventing a debate. His message was, basically, anyone who disagreed with him was equivalent of a flat earther. And so just listen to me and my, you know, handpicked proponents of deistic evolution and get them to buy off on that without listening to anyone on the other side, without, and you know, he would go, and Christian group after Christian group enabled this. I write about how the official group of all the Protestant Christian colleges, the coalition of Christian colleges and universities, invited him to lecture people on theistic evolution and invited them to lecture college leaders, but did not invite anyone on the other side. And this happened with group after group that basically, because they were so smitten, oh, he's on the cover of Time magazine. So it wasn't just Collins, like with Stanley, you have to, well, why did Collins get such a big platform? It wasn't just because of Time magazine or the secular groups, it's because many avowedly Christian groups and pastors like sadly, Tim Keller, whose own denomination actually had views that were completely contrary to Collins' views on creation, they helped platform. I mean, it was Tim Keller who used his prestige to invite people to these private get-togethers to basically only hear one side. And when Keller was invited by Discovery Institute, actually by me personally, to do something similar for people to hear from intelligent design proponents, and I actually had a Christian foundation that he respected ready to fund it, Keller begged off.
Let me ask you a poignant question. Can Christianity and neo-Darwinism be reconciled in any sense?
No. Now, that's because what neo-Darwinism is, let's be clear, it's not just deals with age issues. It doesn't even just deal with common ancestry. It claims that life, as we know it, biological life is the product of an unguided process. Darwin's whole point in his theory was to come up with a designer substitute. And that, in his view, natural selection acting on random variations, today they say random mutations or genetic drift or other things, that was unguided. And what do I mean by that? That means that the end goal, so for example, humans or other things were not the end goal of evolution. They weren't anticipated. The process wasn't directed at that. It was radically, you know, dependent on chance and necessity. And with no designer, you know, planning, or foresight. And so that's what neo-Darwinism is in its core definition. Now, can you have a type of guided evolution that is more or less faithful to certain parts of the Christian faith? Yeah, I think you can. I don't really buy that myself, and we could delve into that. But neo-Darwinism, let's just be clear, at its core claims that life is the product of an unguided process. So at best, the only way you can reconcile it is, well, really the two ways, and I talk about this in the book, you either basically deny that God really was responsible, and you see this when Collins is trying to say, well, you know, there's all this junk DNA, God wouldn't have done it that way, or you say that God himself didn't know the future, and so you're denying he's responsible, or you go the route of Collins and say, well, maybe in some subjective sense, God did do it, but the evidence shows otherwise. And in that case, you know, you might be able to get along with your secularist friends because you say, well, I believe that God is creator and that he guided things, but I don't claim that there's any evidence of that. That's just my subjective feeling, and I concede that the evidence looks like it was undirected. So those are your alternatives. But imagine that. That's watering things down. And also, you know, think of the Romans 1 or Psalm 19 or the clear talkings even of Jesus, where he talks about, he refers to the birds of the air or the lilies of the field as examples of seeing in nature things about the character of God. So the Bible, let alone, you know, early church fathers, let alone, you know, Christian philosophers through the ages, have always said that God's book of nature points to him. And so people who try to meld Darwinism with Christian theism at the very least devalue that, and often they go further and say God himself doesn't know the future, and so that's how you can reconcile genuinely unguided evolution with you know, God not knowing the future. And then, of course, there are some issues with regard to the fall, because Francis Collins' compatriot in arms in establishing BioLogos was a guy named Carl Giberson, and also Daryl Falk, but Carl Giberson wrote a book that Francis Collins endorsed called Saving Darwin, where Giberson explicitly says that, you know, evolution, in a Darwinian sense of evolution, we were never morally innocent or good. We were basically selfish to begin with, because evolution is trying to survive at all costs. And so there was nothing to fall from. In other words, we were botched and sinful and evil to begin with.
Which is the evolutionist paradigm, right? I mean,
correct. Yeah. And this was in a book that was for people to say, well, Collins didn't say that point, and that's true. Collins, though, endorsed that book and wrote a foreword to it.
Is it a bridge too far to say that theistic evolution is the worst of all possibilities? Because you are now blaming God for evolution.
I'd have to think about that, whether it's the worst of all possibilities, but it is a pretty bad synergy. It doesn't really fit. And it really does call, and if you look in people's personal lives of the people who adopt that, sadly, it often doesn't stay with that, because once you have to compromise God's sovereignty, once you have to compromise God's goodness, things follow from that. And so one of the stories I tell, you know, I have a chapter about the slippery slope. You know, people often dismiss the slippery slope, but I think that if you take your cues from the culture and the culture is going down into the ground, then you're going to slide right along with it. And so in the modern debates over intelligence, I say in the 1990s, one of the key figures, one of the key opponents of people like Phil Johnson or Michael Behe was a physicist at Calvin University, Howard Van Til. And he was trying to say, well, you know, there was God's design, but it was all front-loaded and really didn't play out into anything else. And he was trying to create a third way, still cited today, but what people don't actually say. In fact, as of just a few years ago, I was on a platform with Carl Giberson where he was citing this as how an Orthodox evangelical could embrace Darwinian theory. But the sad truth is that Howard Van Til, by the time he retired from Calvin, was then describing himself as a free thinker. He was no longer evangelical. And then by the time he died just a couple of years ago, he had gone all the way to an utter materialist. He actually wrote an essay that he believed in a comprehensive naturalistic worldview, basically without the need of any creator at all. So in his own personal life, at least, that was just a stopping point, and it wasn't very solid. And Carl Giberson himself is very sad. He hasn't gone quite full, at least publicly, the way Howard Van Til, but one of his last books was published by the Unitarian Universalist Association, and it raises questions that, you know, Jesus may not have even been divine, that was something Paul created. And I mean, just poor Carl Giberson is on the same tragic slope, you know, as I think Howard Van Til.
Frankie Schaeffer as well.
Frankie Schaeffer is another really sad, particularly poignant, because as I said, I dedicated my book to Francis Schaeffer, and it's very sad at how, you know, he started, you know, one way, then he gravitated a little bit, and then he was going to a church where he was saying, well, I go, I don't really believe it, but it sort of is mysterious, and so that gives my life meaning. Then it was, I'm an atheist who believes that God doesn't exist, but then sometimes I do, he, she, or it exists, and sometimes I think he doesn't. And so it's just, so he's an atheist who sort of believes in God. What does that mean? And then more recently, he's just, you know, on like on the pro-life thing to overturn Roe v. Wade, which until nearly the very end of his flipping, he was still saying, you know, Roe v. Wade was wrong. But then when it actually got overturned, oh, this is one step away from, this is Ayatollah Khomeini territory. This is theocracy. This is, I mean, it's just, he's really sad, you know.
Yeah, you have on the one hand, the Apostle Paul saying in Romans chapter 2, God's eternal power, divine nature, clearly seen through what has been made so that men are without excuse. And then you have this capitulation to the evolutionary paradigm, which seems to be at the base of most of the issues that we're facing today. If you dig down deep enough, you find that the evolutionary paradigm becomes a foundation on which all of these isms are built.
Yes. And I, you know, we get into that in sexuality and race and a lot of other things. And I think that's true. Let me just say with, before we go on from Collins, is that these arguments about Collins' views on creation were really clear. But a lot of Christians were so enamored by someone who was, well, he's on the cover of Time magazine, that they weren't willing to pay attention to it. And I think the tragic cost of that is, so Collins was picked to be the head of the NIH under Obama. But how did he govern in there? And the thing is, the things that I'm about to talk about now have created consternation, but you could go back pre-Obama and you'll find some of these things in Collins' record, but people didn't want to focus on it. So then you got Christians supporting him to be at the NIH. Well, what is his record there? It's basically indistinguishable from a secular materialist. He spent millions of our tax dollars to create a national tissue bank at the University of Pittsburgh that harvested aborted baby parts from aborted babies up to 42 weeks in gestation. I mean, that's just flat out infanticide, to do medical experiments. For example, one of the medical experiments funded also by the NIH was to take the scalps from these little babies and graft them into mice. That's not great. But the thing is, where do you, if you had read his book, The Language of God, and read the appendix to it, you would have known that he didn't defend the idea that life begins at conception. He wasn't willing to say, he really dissed that. So that predated his time in government service. And so what he did in government service followed that, you know, earlier capitulation. And that's really tragic. But it wasn't just that. So, the one other thing about abortion is somehow maybe he felt he must have known that it wasn't completely kosher, because the only reason we know that we spent that money harvesting those aborted baby parts is because Francis Collins didn't want you to know. A group called Judicial Watch filed a public documents request, and the NIH refused. They had to go to court to force Francis Collins' NIH to divulge what they were spending their tax dollars on harvesting aborted baby parts. But then let's go over into the transgender madness. By the end of his tenure there, Collins was identifying himself in a letter that he wrote to all of the people who worked there as an ally and advocate, his words, of the LGBTQIA movement, and basically urging everyone, you know, in his employ that they have to be that. And he was sort of dismissive of himself as a white cisgender male. Now, cisgender is a terrible word, it's a put down for normal sexuality, but he was using that term. And then even worse, they spent millions of more dollars funding a hospital in Boston, a doctor in California that were promoting surgeries on young women, you know, cutting off breasts of, you know, teenage girls, filling kids with puberty blockers. So that was also, and we're even now we're finding out more grants. I mean, some of this has come out after he left, but there were grants that were done during his tenure. And then finally, of course, during COVID, you know, Christians had sincere differences of opinion. And so that's, I'm not challenging that. But during COVID, he demonized Christians who had sincere conscience-based objections to not take the COVID vax. And he also really promoted these really draconian mandates where tens of thousands of Christians of good conscience lost their jobs and livelihoods. And so what I fault him with is not that he, you know, pushed his view of what people should do, but he did it in a way that demonized fellow Christians who had sincere, and I would say in the light of history, serious qualms about some things, and he weaponized the Bible. So in clear biblical teachings, he wasn't willing to stand up on, like God is creator in the way, but in the, when it came to COVID, he weaponized love thy neighbor, that if you weren't willing, if you had a conscience-based objection to the COVID vax, you were responsible. In one of the interviews he did, I think it was with MSNBC, maybe it was CNN, he basically said, yeah, you were responsible for the deaths of children.
One of the chapters that was so revealing to me was your chapter 3, Sexual Suicide. And by the way, the chapter titles are brilliant. But you talk about how Stockholm Syndrome Christians damaged the understanding of sex and gender. And you make the point that there's a direct connection between Darwinian evolution and what's happened with respect to the evolution with respect to ideas related to sex and gender. This is a very important chapter, and you make your very first point in this chapter, the horror of redefining marriage.
Yeah. Well, actually, I also, just to be clear, because I think the redefinition of marriage is really, really central, but it's also a point I'm trying to make is that heterosexual promiscuity and heterosexual devaluation of marriage and heterosexual no-fault divorce are areas where the church compromised before. You can't just start with the redefinition of marriage, say, you know, being between two or three whomever people. You have to actually look, well, what were the compromises and the things that the church made that led up to that? Because you don't immediately graft on to same-sex marriage, or now I think people are discussing polyamory or stuff. You started with this, many churches seeding grounds on outside of marriage heterosexual activity. And so I want to make that clear, because I think that is one of the distinctives. But you're right, the Darwinian case, people don't really understand that, you know, Darwin wrote a book called The Descent of Man, where he redefines morality as basically that which promotes survival in any given situation. And he has a whole discussion of marriage. And, you know, Darwin in his 19th century proper Victorian view, I mean, would basically say that marriage, monogamous marriage, was that which we evolved to for 19th century Victorian society. So he was, in his own personal views, was fairly, you know, conventional and even conservative. But he adopts a really radical view of what sexual morality or any morality is and of sexual relations, that then when other people believe that, then that just took off. And so in marriage, the thing is, there's nothing particularly sacrosanct about monogamous marriage. He actually says that the original form of marriage, if you will, wasn't really marriage. It was communal sex, basically, having sex with multiple partners, you know, all the time. And then, so depending, his point is, depending on what you need under the given environmental circumstances for survival and flourishing, that's what natural selection will pick. So yes, in our society right now, in his society, that happened to be monogamous marriage, but he really clearly said that depending on how circumstances change, which circumstances can also be technology, you invent the birth control pill, I mean, that's a change, then the dictates of what's moral, what's sexually moral, change. And many people know about Alfred Kinsey, but they don't understand that Alfred Kinsey was trained as an evolutionary biologist. And so when he wrote his influential book about sex in the human male, that really in the late 40s, but then 50s and 60s, helped feed the sexual revolution, he was coming at it with a Darwinian worldview, which is basically, well, if it exists somewhere in nature, If a practice exists somewhere, even in some niche in nature, it must have been favored by natural selection for that purpose. So it's all equally natural. You can't criticize it. And that really provided this scientific basis or argument that pushed a whole generation of sexologists that really set the stage ultimately for the redefinition of marriage and for the redefinition of biological sex and, the denial of biological sex. And the irony is today, some of the leading Darwinian evolutionists like Colin Wright or Richard Dawkins, to their credit, have not embraced the abandonment of sex, male and female, but they don't realize how their desacralizing of nature and, that nature is simply this product of this blind, purposeless process, and whatever is dictated, for survival, nature will choose, which means it's not chosen by anything. And they don't realize that that view leads to a view, well, why should you respect? Yes, we have men and women now, but if we, through our technology, can surmount that, why not? What's the in principle objection? Because ultimately, nothing biological can be grounded in some sort of transcendent nature, because there is no transcendent nature or designer. And so I have to say it's sort of a tragedy that, I wouldn't say heroes, tragic figures of some of the most hardcore Darwinian evolutionists who have ushered forth a society that even some of them are horrified by now.
Yeah, I always say the redefinition of marriage, if you change the meaning of a word, like marriage, you change the thing itself. And you point out in your book that Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is a lifelong Roman Catholic Christian, holds that marriage as historically defined fosters little more than ill will and animosity. So in his considered opinion, anyone who embraces the historical definition of marriage and therefore excludes same-sex couples does so out of hate and animus. And I have written that what must surely have been self-evident to this supremely erudite arbiter of justice is that virtually every redefinition of marriage, including his own, excludes someone. But is that due to hate or is it due to common sense? If marriage means everything, in the end, it can mean nothing at all. And marriage is not a tangential issue. I mean, it's one of the pillars of civilization. It's at the very bedrock of all of civilization.
And that's what people often don't understand who are seeding ground on marriage. Then let's go along over to like poverty issues and long-term poverty. Well, once you've seeded that marriage isn't important and that traditional family isn't important, and then you're trying to talk about the problems that creates for poverty, you don't realize these are dominoes and that they, you think, oh, well, what happens in the bedroom stays in the bedroom. That's not true. I mean, we know, say, in the area of poverty, that the best predictor of long-term intergenerational poverty in America, whether you're white, black, Asian, Hispanic, is whether you have an intact family, a mother and a father. And if you don't, the chances of the dysfunction of your kids, and this is nothing about those people who are forced to be, in a single parent situation who do their absolute best and some good things can come of that. But as a whole, that is not the model. And so once you seed marriage in the intact family, you create massive problems that we've seen actually in long-term intergenerational poverty and dysfunction. But the other thing you mentioned, Anthony Kennedy, that I just like to stress, and this gets back to the main point of the book, which is we are always, as Christians, I find myself, going against the theological liberals and things, but we have to realize our own complicity in the Christian community of getting our own house in order. Anthony Kennedy was not only appointed by Ronald Reagan, he was known in his personal life as a goody-goody. He was a devout weekly mass goer, part of a church, the Catholic Church, that has officially a biblical view of marriage. He was the one who was the deciding vote. Why this matters? The reason we have a phony constitutional right for same-sex marriage that doesn't exist in the Constitution is not because of someone appointed by a Democrat, not because of a loony atheist, a mask-going, goody-goody, Ronald Reagan appointed justice. He was the deciding vote. And similarly, when we talk about and it's not, you know, Catholics, we talked earlier about Jimmy Carter. I mean, Jimmy Carter was a devout evangelical Christian, but he is embracing in the end of his life before he died that Jesus would love gay marriage. You know, Jesus would love, I think he said, you know, anything that didn't harm someone else. I'd say gay marriage does harm people, but you know, anything, any relationship, you know, would be fine with Jesus. So there you have the nation's most prominent born-again Christian politician making that argument. And then when it comes to who's persecuting the bakers and the florists and the other people, you know, who don't want to be conscripted to support gay marriage, well, in many cases, it's people who identify as Christian. So in my home state of Washington, we had a Christian grandmother who had a longtime floral shop, and she would sell to everyone. But when it came to developing particular flower arrangements just specifically for a gay wedding, she didn't want to do that. She'd sell them flowers, but she didn't want to be a participant in that. She no longer has her floral shop. She was driven out of existence. The person who drove her out of existence was not an atheist. It was a church-going Catholic attorney general. He's now our governor, unfortunately, in my view, Bob Ferguson, who actually wrote an article at the time defending his persecution of her as part of his faith commitment. I mean, in other words, as part of being a good person of faith, a good Catholic, was driving her out of existence. Andy Stanley, who we talked about earlier, disparaged Christians who didn't, business people who didn't want to participate in gay weddings. So don't think that this is just the big bad secularists who are putting this on it. It's people who self-identify as Christians. And if we don't get our own house in order, it's hard to expect better results.
And you know, it's really interesting. You get this sense in reading through your book that the slippery slope that you've been talking about in the podcast, and you certainly talk about in the book, is dangerous not only for civilizations, for countries, but also for individuals. And you point this out and give example after example after example of people that start down this road. And once you start down that road, you gain momentum. You give up this pristine principle, and then it's easier to give up the next one. And pretty soon you're gaining speed as you go down that slope.
That's exactly right. And especially if the culture is getting worse, and you're taking your cues from the culture, so it's sliding down, it's going to drag you down with it. And another case in my book is a pastor, former pastor, Ryan Meeks, celebrated as one of the new breed of evangelicals just a few years ago in Time magazine. Why? Well, because his congregation repented against, you know, not affirming the gay and lesbian lifestyle and actually started to do gay weddings. But he claimed to be an evangelical in doing this. Well, as I say in the book, if you check out his church today, it doesn't exist. It went out of existence. And if you actually check about its history, shortly with, you know, after that time that he was trumpeted in Time magazine as a new breed of evangelical, that church no longer even identified as specifically Jesus-oriented or Christian. I mean, and then he left altogether, and you can find his website. People go to my links. Now he doesn't call himself a Christian. I'm not even sure he's a theist, but he helps people on their journeys, including especially with psychedelic drugs. He now lives in Oregon with his wife, and so he has a whole new ministry. So yeah, if you look at the personal trajectory, a lot of the people upheld as these, you know, the new paradigm of the new teaching for Orthodox or evangelical Christians that actually is the old heresies, it doesn't end well. It's really tragic for these people. And of course, it's tragic for the people who they mislead.
Yeah, I remember his famous quip, gay or straight here, there's no hate here. And he popularized that particular quip. But anyway, chapter 4, Rebuilding the Walls of Hostility, this is an important chapter as well, where you talk about how Stockholm Syndrome Christianity produces this divisive view of race and class. Talk about the anti-racist movement. It sounds so good, but there's a distinct problem with anti-racism.
Yeah, and here's a tragedy, again, of Christians who don't want to really defend the Bible because they, without good teaching, you know, I think the Bible is the greatest engine of human dignity and equality in the history of mankind. I mean, no question. And so if you're not willing to draw on that resource, then you basically, there's the gap. And so what has filled the gap are these so-called anti-racism, which really is just racism. But it comes back. I mean, let's go back to the Darwinian story. Darwin, again, thought human beings weren't created in the image of God. We descended with common ancestors from ape-like creatures. And then that helped fuel discussions of higher and lower races, who was more evolved than others. And that really debuted and fomented a view of scientific racism and the idea that race defines you more than, you know, your fellow religious beliefs or other beliefs. And where did that lead? Well, on the left, it led to people who basically, you know, they say they're against racism, but they imbibe this underlying structure that they actually think race or ethnicity is paramount. And so they just disagree about who the oppressor class is. So if they're being oppressed, the idea is that they should become, in essence, the oppressor. And so it's all about power. It's not about building common ground. It's not about building, you know, that all people are created equal and that we should be aspiring to equal standards and loving one another because we're all created in the image of God. It's that, no, they buy into, yeah, there are, it's all about power and these tribal groups, these racial groups. And so if we happen to be Black or Hispanic or whatever, we should identify with our own, and then we should be pushing back about, you know, anyone else as the oppressor. And the thing is, this is also, you know, I write about this a little bit in the book. It's become more pronounced since I wrote the book. But so you have that on the left. You have something that's really disturbing on the right that mimics it among secularists on the right, but also among some self-described, I don't think they're accurately described as in the Reform view, where they basically accept this diagnosis that, yeah, it's all about race and tribalism. And they just say, well, but since we're white, we should be supreme. And so they're actual white supremacists. And the thing is, both of these ideas, which have some derivation from Darwinian evolution, are false. And the tragedy of the Christians who stood out and weren't preaching biblical equality is there was a vacuum for these noxious pseudo-Darwinian and other views to just rush in. And I think that's what we're seeing. And to go back to Andy Stanley, I think you see a microcosm of how this happens. He has a really poignant story in his book, Irresistible, about how a father came to him early in his career with his daughter, and his daughter was dating a Black man and wanted to marry him. And he wanted Andy Stanley to, you know, read the Riot Act to his daughter and to tell her that, you know, in God's view, that, you know, this was an abomination because, and the example he gave is that God was irate with Moses for marrying a Black woman. Well, I mean, the clearest thing to say on that, well, first of all, is that's completely false. In fact, God was upset with Miriam and Aaron for being upset that Moses married who he married. And so it's the complete opposite. But what is Andy Stanley? How is he using this? He actually says, well, you know, I didn't really want to get into a debate over this, and, you know, that wasn't really productive. And so he you know, said something about, you know, do you want to lose your daughter or do you want to hold to your ideas? And okay, maybe pastorally that made sense in that situation. I don't know. But he uses it as an example for why we should abandon the Old Testament. He uses it as, well, see, you know, the Old Testament leads to things like racism, rather than, I mean, I would use an example of, this is why we get things like critical race theory on the left and then sort of the racialism on the fringe of the right, is because people like Andy Stanley aren't willing to give good teaching. I mean, the Bible, like I said, is an engine of human dignity and equality from Genesis to Revelation. And for a Christian pastor to not give good teaching, I mean, I'd say that the father who came to see him, the fact that that father had such a distorted view of what the Bible said is an example of the, not of the Old Testament failure, but the failure of Christian preachers like Andy Stanley to actually tell them what the Bible actually says.
Yeah, and a beautiful point. And you say that the Bible has served as the greatest bulwark against racism, and the Bible has also helped people understand equality of human beings throughout human history. So this is the bulwark, and the Bible's actually being denigrated. I mean, that's the insidious nature of this.
It is. And this is yet another fruit of not being willing to defend the authority of the Bible, is now we see it in the area of race. And like I said, you see it on the left, but you also see it, these pernicious people on the right who claim to be Christians, who are themselves, if you read their works, are imbibing Darwinian evolution. They actually cite Darwinian arguments for racism. I mean, this is, it's such a tragedy, because you're right, the Bible, one reason why I think actually people should read creation stories from other religions is not because I think they're true, because they're not, but they'll begin to see just how absolutely unique the Bible's creation story is. I mean, if you read, say, the Laws of Manu, the Hindu creation story, where we don't reflect God's image, we reflect the image of different pieces of the gods. And so some people are actually in the image of the feet, and they are only meant to be slave classes. I mean, in their creation story, inequality is built in. Compare that to what the Bible teaches of male and female created in the image of God. I mean, this was a radically, I mean, we are so, because we're living in the light of this type of thinking, you know, from the Bible, people take it for granted. But if the Bible had never existed, a lot of things would be awful. But, you know, this idea of human equality, it comes from there. And then, you know, certainly Christians, when I see some right-wing Christians now saying that their ethnicity is more important, that they have more to share with, say, fellow American-born, you know, Americans of their same race than they do with Christians in Africa. Well, that's absolutely false. I mean, one of the great joys of being a Christian when I travel is being with Christians of other races, ethnicities, nationalities, and realizing how much, you know, we have that we share together. In fact, it's a tremendous thing that almost everywhere in the world you travel here, you actually have brothers and sisters. And for anyone who has traveled, and you know, I haven't traveled as much as many people, but when I have traveled, especially outside the United States, let alone in different areas of the United States, having brothers and sisters, finding a biblical church is one of the most inspiring, powerful things that could ever happen. And so, and then just the history of getting rid of slavery and the arguments against that, and some of the misconstruals of people thinking the Bible was pro-slavery. No, it's not. And, you know, I go through that in a little bit of depth in there. So I'm trying to equip people here also that when they hear these objections, to actually articulate a biblical view of equality. And it's, I think, so tragic post, say, 2020. And, you know, I don't think it was tragic in 2020 that with George Floyd's death and things, that many white Christians began to think we really need to face the issues we have in our society about race and ethnicity. That was honorable. The problem is, rather than going to the Bible and going to the rich Christian tradition to teach about equality and dignity, many of them went to places like, you know, the church that I was in. You know, people wanted to read Robin DiAngelo, who's white, I mean, a white woman, White Fragility, which is not at all biblical. And it's just, it's really pernicious. And so the tragedy is so many Christian churches aped the culture rather than going to the rich Christian tradition of biblical teaching on human equality and dignity.
A couple comments on your fifth chapter where you say we must obey men rather than God. That's the chapter title. The subtitle really points out that Stockholm Syndrome Christians abandoned religious liberty.
Yeah. And this gets to the point that, again, it's not just the big, bad, nasty atheists and secularists who are our problem. If you look time and again, there are Christians who are facilitating a lot of the persecution, either directly, like the former Attorney General of Washington that I talked about earlier, or by refusing to talk about it, refusing to defend people, refusing to speak up for people. And so that is really sad. And I think actually, you know, during the COVID era of some of the endless lockdowns and the mandates, and this also, I think, creates some controversy, because I, on the COVID mandates, which I think were unjust, and I think that some Christians who demonize their fellow Christians were wrong, I cite examples from both parts of the political spectrum. So you had David French, who's an evangelical columnist at the New York Times, who's very anti-Trump. But then you have Robert Jeffress, conservative Trump supporter, Baptist Church in Dallas, who a lot of more conservative Christians really love. Both of them, though, demonized Christians who didn't feel that they could take the COVID vax. And I think that that is really sad and tragic. And again, I'm not saying if they had said, well, I think it's good for these reasons, so that's why you think you should take it. But no, David French wrote a piece basically accusing everyone who disagreed for whatever reason of having hardness of heart that so hard, their hearts are so hard that virtue can't penetrate. I mean, it was really high voltage stuff. And similarly, Baptist Robert Jeffress boasted to the news media that he did not offer any exemptions to his own staff of his Baptist church. Now, Baptists historically are strong believers in religious liberty. I mean, I think that's really, really tragic.
And there were some really good reasons that people had for not taking the COVID vaccine. I mean, I took it because I had to travel around the world and I couldn't travel without taking the vaccine. My wife did not, and she had valid reasons for not wanting to take it. There were reasons that included the fact that the derivation of the vaccine itself had systemic problems.
Yes. I mean, and certainly in some of the testing, depending on the particular vaccine, there was the use of some cell lines derived from aborted fetal cell lines. And then also, I mean, I would broaden it out. If you're a parent, I mean, and I'll be honest, I did not end up taking the COVID vaccine, neither did my wife or kids. Now, part of it was because we ended up getting COVID, and so there was no reason in our view to take an additional vaccine. But we know a lot of people who chose for some very serious reasons, you know, some who were pregnant, who were, you know, it was a little bit unclear of how it affect pregnant women, and say young men. I mean, it's now well established that if you're a young male in good health, you probably shouldn't be taking those COVID vaccines because of the heart issues with that. And in fact, I know of some cases personally where that was the case. And so if you're a parent, so and someone like Robert Jeffress or David French would say, well, that's not a religious objection. That's not a conscious objection. That's, you know, that's just a secular objection, so it doesn't matter. Well, who's actually, if you're a parent of, say, a 13-year-old boy, who is responsible ultimately before God for the safety and care and raising of that child? It's not Anthony Fauci or Francis Collins or David French, for that matter. It's the parent. And so if the parent has, you know, serious reasons to be concerned that, you know, say their kid is in good health and they're reading this material that's coming out about the problems with heart issues, that is a particular, I'd say that they were called by God to follow their conscience there and protect their child. And that is an issue of religious liberty and conscience, because it's the parents who are supposed to be responsible for their kids, not the government. And so I think some of these people who say, oh, there's no religious liberty component in here, were just such a narrow view of religious liberty that it's really concerning. And now we know, actually, I mean, the government made, and we could get into this for all sorts of things, but you know, the government made no distinction between those who actually had COVID before and whether they should have these vaccine mandates. But we now know, just a few months ago, we now know that there was a meeting with Francis Collins, the head of the CDC, and some epidemiologists early on, where they basically all agreed, they all conceded that scientifically, that if you had already had COVID, really the vaccine provided no additional benefit. Where they disagreed, and that's why they didn't publicly acknowledge this at the time, was, oh, well, that would create a PR issue and it would, you know, create inconsistent messaging. And so it wasn't about the science, it was about the PR message. Well, I'm sorry, that I don't think that's ethically defensible. And we now know this because someone who participated in the meeting who agreed with the COVID vax has come forward to share about the meeting. And so I think there were a lot of issues where I think a lot of Christians need to apologize to how they treated their fellow Christians. And again, people should hear me. It's not because if someone took the COVID vax or thought that was right, fine. Or if someone supported COVID lockdowns, fine. It's how they treated the people who disagreed with them on an issue that at best was arguable among Christians. And I, you know, Paul does talk about this with regard to eating food that has been offered to idols and stuff, and talking about respecting on things that are not non-negotiable biblical things, respecting the conscious beliefs of your fellow Christians. And I think that we had a lot of Christian leaders who failed at that. They were so rah-rah that, and they could have, again, they could have shared their own perspective without demonizing, you know, the people on the other side who suffered a great deal. I mean, I know people who lost their jobs. I know people who actually had to take the COVID vax against their will who ended up being vaccine injured. I mean, it's just, I think there needs to be some ownership on the part of some Christian leaders about their complicity in this.
Yeah, let's talk a little about listening to the wrong voices, your chapter 7, where you discuss root causes of Stockholm Syndrome Christianity. What makes, in other words, Christians susceptible to Stockholm Syndrome Christianity? And you give a whole list, starting with traditional news media. And when you're listening to the wrong voices, you're going to be stuck in this psycho-epistemological cocoon. You can't break out of it. Once you determine your paradigm, then your paradigm determines you. And so often, this is the root cause. You're listening to the wrong voices.
Yeah. So thank you for raising that, because, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking about the problems, and there is that in the book, and that's a main feature of the book. But then I do shift over into several chapters of, you know, what are the root causes? What are things we can do about it? Because my goal in this book is not just to be another book that criticizes, but is to provide some, you know, positive things that people can do and some understanding of, you know, how we can avoid. And you're exactly right. I think one of the absolute most important things, when I've seen my own, you know, friends at church or colleagues at, you know, when I was a college professor, of where people begin to go awry, it's they're listening to the wrong voices. And so many people don't realize, you know, they think that, well, you know, I have a solid Christian worldview, so it doesn't matter what I'm reading or looking at, because or I'm just, you know, reading a news source that, oh, it's just a neutral source. Well, that's just not true. And whether it be social media or Wikipedia or search engines, or let alone the traditional media, all of this is curated for you largely by people who are hostile to the Christian faith. Now, that doesn't mean that they can't have some accurate information there, but it does mean you need to be really careful. And it does mean that if that's all you're filling your mind with, don't be cocky. Because, for example, if you have, and I've seen this with some people, say you start out with a biblical view of biblical sexuality. But then you're told, you read news article after news article that says, well, you know, that's not biologically realistic, or, you know, this is how people are born with this, or this is, you know, and you just read ad nauseum these things that seek to say, well, in the real world, this isn't true. Then you, at the very least, have this tension between what the Bible has taught you and then what you think real world is showing. So these sources of information about daily life are really important if you're not getting good information. And what I try to do in that particular chapter is go through in detail and sort of show people, I mean, who are the people who are making these choices and how does it impact you? Even something as simple as that people don't think about, the agenda setting function of the news media. You know, at one time, I mean, America still, for like compared to most of Western Europe, is still much more religiously devout in terms of church attendance and prayer and a lot of other things. You would never know that from our secular media. I mean, several generations ago in the 19th century, you would actually have reports of sermons on Sunday at big churches. Now, you don't have that now. Now, is that because objectively religion isn't so interesting anymore? Well, I go through the stats. If you actually compare the number of people who attend church weekly or a couple times a month versus those who go to movie theaters or go to sporting events and stuff, church wins out. And so objectively speaking, we still have a lot of people who are really concerned about their relationship to God, but our media sources do not reflect that. And so if you're listening to all these secular media sources, you're imbibing this idea that your religion really isn't important. It's something only that you're interested in, that culturally it's all the other side when it's actually not. And so you end up transforming and being manipulated by that. Now, the good news that there are now lots of good media sources. And so actually, if you're listening to this podcast, this is one. I mean, the work of Christian Research Institute over the last, you know, generations has been to give discernment and equip people and help. And so this is a great information source. And there are others for news and other things. And so I, you know, the real encouragement, I end that chapter talking about the Bereans, which we mentioned before. You know, the Bereans heard stuff, but then they compare it to the Bible. They wanted to, you know, compare, you know, what was really the case. And so I think I'm calling for people to be discerning, but to be discerning, you need to make sure that you're getting decent information sources and that your kids are getting decent information sources, and that you're, if you're a pastor, that your parishioners are getting decent information sources, because if they're not, they're going to become like what they are listening to.
Yeah, and social media is a big part of that.
Yes. And so I deal also with social media, but I will say that a lot of stuff on social media, the agenda is still set by more traditional outlets, because you're sharing stories, you're commenting on stories that are made possible by the rest of the media. But yes, social media, a lot of things are censored. Algorithms push some things over other things. And so, yeah.
Yeah, and you point that out in your book. I mean, you talk about algorithms, Google. Search engines are critical in terms of what you're steered towards and what you're steered from.
That's true. I give an example that people can use in their own life of searching for, in not just Google, but other search engines, crisis pregnancy center. And I'll tell you that often what will come up is lots of Planned Parenthoods or a site that actually calls itself Pregnancy Center Finder that is actually a hit site attacking pro-life pregnancy centers. And so you would, from that, if you don't dig deep down in the list, you think, well, there aren't any good, crisis pregnancy centers, or these are all a bad thing. And, you know, the new thing on the horizon is a lot of people and a lot of Christians are relying increasingly on AI chatbots. And this is really worrisome for a more general reason. It's not just bias. It's chatbots, these AI things like ChatGPT or a lot of the other ones, they don't have minds. And so they can't be programmed for truth. And so what you're getting is this mishmash of stuff that conjugates sentences and concepts that technically it will read well, but it may be false. And it's hard for you to know. I mean, I give an example where I engaged in, you know, research on a chatbot over intelligent design and what the courts have said about it. And I got fake citations of court cases that never existed. And, you know, one party was from a real case, you know, so it was like, say, Smith versus Jones, and maybe Smith came from one case, Jones came from another case, and it was a mishmash in it. And it would actually say, well, an Alabama Supreme Court in 2000, whatever, gave this case, and there was no case. And this is ubiquitous among these AI chatbots. And so this is a really bad way of trying to get your information.
So the Russians didn't actually send bears up into space?
No, yes, the case I use in there, which is really humorous. I think of the old Muppet Show, Bears in Space, but we did some chimps and stuff. But so chatbot after chatbot basically claims that the Russians sent this series of bears into space, and they'll even give you names of the bears, you know, the Alyosha, and I forget what the names are, but it's all fake.
Vladimir was one of them.
Vladimir.
So another thing that I want to get at in this podcast, which I think is so important, is the entertainment media. I've often said that the ballot box is necessary. We so often talk about elections and the criticality of elections, and the ballot box is certainly necessary. But people's views are so often determined by the educational institutions, by the environmental institutions, by the entertainment institutions. So we have to be so careful about entertainment media as one of those major issues.
Yeah, no. So I think they're at two levels. You know, one, I think some Christians will understand, although not enough. You know, one is just the gratuitous sex, unbiblical behavior, values confusion, transgender confusion. And so that's one thing. But then even in more family-friendly things, if the messaging can be really sinister. And so let me give an example that might offend some of your viewers, but I know a lot of Christians love sort of the Hallmark Channel. And I don't dislike the Hallmark Channel. And, you know, I know a lot of Christians who loved all the Hallmark Christmas movies. But, you know, overwhelmingly, those Christmas movies aren't really about Christmas. They're not about Jesus. They're very hyper-secular. And so if you are watching 20 Hallmark Christmas movies where maybe one of them has something about the real meaning of Christmas, how are you shaping your view and your mindset and your children's mindset about what the real meaning of Christmas is? And so I use that example to show that it's not just the most obvious things where that you shouldn't be watching or you shouldn't be allowing your kids to watch that's just, you know, filling your mind with filth. It can also be things that are, maybe they're not filthy, but they're really changing your worldview or your reference point of what's important without you even thinking about it. And so, you know, the number one thing is when you do that, you should at least be discerning and realize what you're watching and sort of mentally push back on it. And then I don't think many parents, because, you know, parents are always a generation behind their kids, in at least in the newest technology. I think many parents who didn't grow up in quite the saturated social media environment that we are in now, or the saturated pornography of hardcore pornography environment, aren't sufficiently concerned about what their kids are doing on their iPhones or their Androids or in some of these actually simulation gaming sites. And that can be very, very dangerous and destructive to your kids and to adults for that matter. But, you know.
Yeah. What about this phrase, follow the science wherever it leads? I mean, we got to be true to science. I mean, I've been hearing this on even very conservative shows, follow the science, but that's kind of fraught with all kinds of pitfalls.
Oh, it is. And so, you know, in one sense, I mean, like most slogans, it has a kernel of truth. If you're trying to get at, you know, let's follow what the evidence actually says, the problem is who speaks for science. And what we saw during COVID, but it's not just COVID, we see it in debates over, say, climate change. You have people who are saying, we speak for the science, and therefore, if you raise questions, even if you're a fellow scientist, even if you have degrees from the same prestigious places, even if you've done research, it doesn't matter. If you're a minority dissenting view, we don't have to respond to you. We don't need to listen to you. And you're anti-science because you're raising evidence-based objections. And so here's the problem with science becoming its own ideology of being this catchphrase to actually stand for something other than really science. I mean, if you're using science as this dogmatic phrase to justify and baptize whatever ideological claim you're trying to promote, that you're not a good scientist. And the best of really good scientists are open, you know, to criticism. And in fact, if someone criticizes them, rather than trying to shut them down, they should respond to them and say, well, you know, that really doesn't work out because I think the evidence overwhelmingly points in this direction. But if instead they say, well, let's demonize or shut them down. I mean, this was another problem with Francis Collins during the COVID. It's come out. You know, there were a lot of scientists who disagreed about some of the policies on endless lockdowns. And rather than engage them, the issue was, well, let's just smack them down or let's just, you know, disregard. And that is a danger signal. So I think when you say people say, you know, follow the science, I think the first question should be, well, says who? Who's talking about the science? And then are there any scientists who disagree? And what does the evidence actually show? And at least, you know, be open to asking those questions. And then the people, if you ask questions of people who are saying, well, science says this with a capital S, and they get upset because you're asking questions like this, that's a big danger signal that maybe what they're promoting isn't science after all.
And this is particularly true when it comes to global warming.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, this is, you know, I know Christians have different views, but here, global warming is actually, what is it? It's a constellation of different claims, each of which have to be justified. So one is, has there been a warming period in the last 100 years? So that's one claim. And most people, I think, would agree that there has been, although there's some question that may have leveled off. Then the question is, well, but what are the factors that actually cause that? Well, then there's a lot of disagreement over the things, or, you know, how much is it human? How much is it the sun? How much is it other things? And so that's a separate question that requires its own evidence to answer. And then, well, let's say you even agree on those two things. Well, then what can we do about it? And, you know, can we do something about it? And then what will be the cost of doing something about it? In fact, in order to say, do something about it, are you going to put so many millions of people out of work that you're going to harm them or lead to starvation or things? You know, what are the consequences? So you have these different questions. And the people who want to say, you know, are you with me or against me with global warming? You're a climate change denier. That really is, again, it's a manipulation of science because the actual questions are a set of different questions, each of which have to be answered. And you may answer one way. You may say, well, yeah, there's global warming going on over the past 100 years, but it seems to be part of a natural cycle that, you know, is now leveling off. I mean, the answer to one question doesn't prejudge the answer to the other questions.
Yeah, Jay Richards, your colleague and friend, has done just brilliant work in that regard. Talk about the celebrity culture a little bit. You do in your book, and I think it's important because we not only have celebrities that often we give ear to outside the Christian community, but you have celebrity pastors, so celebrity personalities. I mean, all of us are kind of in danger of that. I mean, you know, people make an idol out of people who are very fallible.
Yeah, so I think that is a big danger. I think there is a component of what has happened to American evangelicalism is that the culture is so enamored with trying to find the next celebrity without asking discerning questions. And I think that is partly an explanation for the rise of Francis Collins. But, you know, we also see it in, I mean, I give an example in the book that at the time Roe v. Wade was decided, Justin Bieber, you know, comes out and basically attacks it. You know, he's for a woman's right to choose, or I forget exactly what he said, which is quite an irony because he exists.
A woman
because
has the right to do whatever she wants to do with her own body. It's a basic quote, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is quite ironic because people who know his personal story, his mom was in a really challenging pregnancy and decided to have him and not have an abortion. So he exists because his mom didn't agree with that. And then the celebrity pastors, the thing is, we know that Christianity is not always popular. And I'd say as the culture gets worse, you know, genuine Christianity probably becomes, you know, less and less popular. And so if you have pastors who are getting the toast of the New York Times or celebrity or the rest of the culture, it may be an indicator that there's not, you know, there's not something great going on. And so that you have to be very discerning about that. But I think that, and we see this also on the right, you know, we see this on the left and the right. And so without being really controversial, I mean, a lot of people now are pining, you know, to uphold Trump as this Christian leader. Well, there's no indication that Trump is really a Bible-believing Christian. And it's not just because of his past life. When he talks about the Bible, it's works-based. There just isn't. Now, that doesn't mean, I would say, I agree with many of his policies. So I know, but this gravitation of Christians to try to look up to celebrities as somehow giving them guidance on Christianity is really dangerous because the whole thing, the people-pleasing nature of celebrities is stuff that actually usually goes against what true Christian teaching is. And so you really should, if you're primarily following people who are the most popular, you should ask why. Now, sometimes, you know, it's for legitimate reasons because people are particularly persuasive or particularly, you know, solid. But people do need to think carefully about, are they just glomming on? And I think some Christians also are insecure. They sort of think that, well, if someone is a Christian who's a celebrity, that, well, that means, you know, I don't need to be insecure because someone is validating Christianity for me. And I think that's also not a healthy idea. And where you see this, one of the probably most explicit examples of how wrong this can go is when in the 1970s, back when Jimmy Carter popularized the idea of being a born-again Christian, and I want to be clear, I think Jimmy Carter himself, you know, had a personal belief in Christ. I don't think his public policies really always went along with that, but I think he was sincere, at least for much of his life. But at that time, for a while, it became popular in culture to be a born-again Christian. And so at one point, you had Larry Flint, the publisher of Penthouse magazine or Hustler, you know, of declaring he was a born-again Christian. Well, how did that end? It didn't really end very well. And by the end of his life, there was nothing different. He kept publishing the porn. It's like people do need to be discerning about glomming on and following people or teachings just because they're popular.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Joel Osteen comes to mind. I actually, many years ago, wrote a little book called The Osteenification of American Christianity, where really Jesus becomes a means to an end as opposed to being the end. And he invites people to the master's table, not for the love of the master, but because of what's on the master's table. So it's a complete perversion of authentic Christianity. You offer so many good suggestions on what Christians can do, including choosing your information and entertainment sources wisely, and don't let your information or your entertainment sources shape you. As you said before during the podcast, become a Berean Christian. Test all things, hold fast to that which is good. I think that's a really important part of the book. I wish we could give more attention to it on the podcast. But in chapter 8, you talk about pleasing the wrong people. And you saw this firsthand as a professor. And I want you to elaborate on that because you have, we still remember this for years and years at the Christian Research Institute, the impact of Mark Knowles' famous book, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. This book had the skin of the truth stuffed with a lie.
Yeah, that's a good description. So, you know, the kernel of truth is that obviously God created our minds, and we should, if you're called to be a scholar, or you should be as excellent as you can be, and you shouldn't be slipshod, you should, all that's good. But who's the standard of excellence? That's really the nub. And this book, which, you know, was toasted by Christianity Today, and when I was at this, you know, Christian university, it was like, oh, that's the book that everyone was trying to be shaped by. What I saw, the way people took it was, well, we need to be accepted by Harvard, the New York Times, the secular culture. That's the test for having an excellent mind. And that's where I think, I mean, this, you know, keys off of what we just talked about, the celebrity culture. It's also, you know, trying to get the approval of a disintegrating secular culture is, I mean, why? That's not excellence from a biblical standpoint or from a truth standpoint. And so that's, and you know, to Mark Knoll's credit, in the first edition of his book, he does have a little caveat that we need to be clear that, you know, the mark of excellence in scholarship isn't just, you know, whether you're toasted by secular society. So he does warn about that. But his book was not, at least in the places that I was dealing with and the colleagues I was dealing with, that's not really, that warning wasn't paid attention to. It was like, this is a clarion call for us to be like Harvard. And that the test is whether people at Harvard or the New York Times, et cetera, are praising us. And then I think that was actually endemic in the book, despite, you know, Mark Knoll's protestation, because just a couple of years ago, Knoll came out with a new edition of his book, where pretty much he says, you know, if you disagreed with him on the COVID vax or on Darwinian evolution or climate change, that's who he's talking about of evangelicals who don't have a mind. So his test is basically, if you disagree with the secular consensus on any of these things, doesn't matter how thoughtful you are, doesn't matter how rigorous your research is, doesn't matter what a good case you make, just by disagreeing on that, that was his indictment. And I think you see, I mean, in a way, I'm grateful for his second edition where he says this, because it sort of rips off the veneer and makes it very clear that what was being pined for was secular acceptance. It wasn't, and in fact, he even talks about in his second book about downgrading the emphasis on Christians being biblically faithful, and actually talks about people's idolatry of the Bible. And then basically, so what is a Christian scholarship to him? Well, it's like, it's this really dumbed down version of Christian ethics of love, and I forget what all, but it's just, it's very thin. And so doctrinal orthodoxy is not part of good scholarship. Well, I'm sorry, if you are, oh, I'm not actually sorry. If you're a doctor, you know, a faithful Christian, truth should be the number one guiding test of good scholarship, not whether it's accepted by the New York Times.
You know, one of the striking parts of your book that sticks in my mind, it's riveted in my mind, is an example. And it's in the Lutheran community. So you have the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod going down a very bad path, but ending up reversing that path. And then you have the Evangelical Lutheran Church, kind of ironic that's called Evangelical, going down the opposite path. Tell that story.
I'm so glad you like it. That was added very late because I knew someone who I didn't know at the time, but she, I taught a Sunday school class that morphed into this book, and she told me about it because her dad was one of the professors, one of the Orthodox professors who stayed. And so then I researched it. And I think Christians need to know about this also to show how faithfulness God can honor, but also if you're not faithful, you can actually see in real time what happens. So the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church in the 1970s, their key seminary, basically it was increasingly dominated by professors who basically adopted the old style theological liberalism, that the Bible wasn't really necessarily accurate, that the miracles didn't necessarily happen, you know, what the Bible said, and they were devaluing that. And so the denomination got worried about it because, you know, this was their future pastors, you know, that were being done. And there were some faithful people in the seminary, but they were increasingly belittled and berated by the increasingly, I'd say, non-Orthodox people there. And so to the credit of the denominational officials at the time is that they did investigate and they wouldn't let go. And when they found out what was really happening, they basically said, well, no, that's not our confession. You know, we have stated confessions that you're supposed to uphold. And they basically insisted on that. And even when they were demonized, I mean, it's really interesting. I went back to some of the original documents, how this played out. They were demonized as being anti-Christian for upholding traditional teaching of biblical authority. They were berated as being unloving. They were berated as Pharisees. I mean, it was high voltage rhetoric against them, but they methodically, carefully said, no, this is what we stand for. These are our confessional faith. That's what our seminary is supposed to stand for. And so then the majority faculty, who by that time had sort of abandoned biblical faithfulness, said, okay, well, if you do that, we're just going to leave and start our own seminary. And basically, I think they were hoping that they would get the denomination to back down, but the denomination didn't. And so something about like basically 90% of the faculty and students left, a faithful remnant stayed. And at the time, the news media was saying, oh, see, they've destroyed the denomination, they've destroyed their seminary, and you know they're going to go out of existence. I would say even if that happened, well, they were staying faithful, and that's, we don't just do things based on success, we do things based on what's right. But an amazing story, within just a few years, they rebuilt the seminary, and the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church went on. It still today has close to 2 million baptized members and is still the largest theologically conservative Lutheran denomination in the United States. And Francis Schaeffer, at the time, actually went to encourage them after this happened, and he gave a chapel. And I found this talk by him that I'd never known before. And in fact, many of the people who read the book, who knew a lot about Schaeffer, didn't know that he went there, where he basically thanked them for what they did and noted that this, you know, in most cases, denominations go heterodox and they're never recovered. This was the first time in his view that he knew in history, certainly in modern American history, where a denomination was going in one direction and they actually flipped it back to faithfulness. And so he was encouraging them. But what's also, so that's the story of faithfulness and all the good that that was led to. But the other part of it is, well, what happened to all these professors and students, future ministers who went into what eventually became the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, which, as you know, is ironic because it's not at all evangelical. Well, these professors who were protesting their innocence that they were really faithful Bible believers, even though they weren't, they helped become leaders in the new denomination of pushing for acceptance of gay marriage, devaluing the Bible, and everything that basically played out in the ECLA. And so you could actually see what would have happened to the future of the Missouri Synod Lutheran had those few denominational officials not had the backbone and the wisdom and the courage, and I'd say the biblical love, to stand for truth. And so you can see on the one side, you know, the benefits of the fruitfulness, and then the consequences of those who left.
Yeah, so you had some faithful board members.
You did. And some denominational officials who the board members were representing.
Yep. You have a section in the book, it starts with cures, and the first chapter is chapter 10, A Call to Wisdom. You talk about what we should do about Stockholm Syndrome Christianity. We should obviously immerse ourselves in the Word of God. I say memorize the Word of God, meditate on the Word of God, mind the Word of God for all its substantial riches. You also talk about the importance of prayer. And, you know, you can sort of brush that aside. I mean, that's sort of understandable. But this is really important. We can talk about it, or we can actually do it. And doing it makes all the difference in the world. I'm sure that was a big part of the transition for the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, there are multiple aspects to prayer, you know, praise, confession, you know, thankfulness. But I also think that I've seen in my work at Discovery, and in one case that I share in the book, of that intercessory prayer is also really, really important. And I tell in the book how when Seattle Pacific brought a big proponent of open theism, this idea that God himself doesn't know the future, to the school to speak in the official chapel and to engage the faculty, my wife and I were part of a young person's Bible study that we helped lead, and we had the leaders, we were all praying that God would basically safeguard the students from this just really erroneous belief. And I later had a discussion, we were discussing other things, with the person who was the dean of the chapel, who supported bringing this person. So it wasn't that he disagreed with the person, but I asked him how that went, because actually at the time I was actually on sabbatical writing another book, Darwin Day in America, I think. So I wasn't actually there. I knew about it, but I didn't attend the chapel. So, but later I asked the person who had arranged it, you know, how that went. And he said, oh, it was one of the worst chapels we ever had because the students just couldn't make a head or tail of what the guy was saying and what his point was. It was just so airy-fairy. And I thought, wow, what an answer to prayer that God sort of made what he said babble to the students. And so I have other things, you know, that I've experienced things like that. I think every, you know, Christian has to a degree, but prayer is really talking to the living God, and God honors our prayers in a variety of different ways. And, but one way is, it's a real treat, is when God, you know, calls you to pray about something and that you can see his particular answer in a way that you can see here and now, and you don't have to wait to heaven to see, you know, the answer. And so I do think that we need to remember we can't do it in our own power. And I know when I was an elder of a church, can think of some very difficult decisions we had to make where spending, you know, an hour walking in prayer, where things really became clear, and it was through praying about it that God sort of made clear, well, this is the key thing. And so, yeah, I think we need to doing God's work in God's way. And that's something Francis Schaeffer liked to talk about. I think they got it from Hudson Taylor, and it's a good thing to remember.
Yeah, and I was so encouraged that you had the temerity to believe that things can change at Seattle Pacific University. You saw a glimmer of hope there. I mean, you're not Pollyannish about it, but you did see a glimmer of hope, and you're even willing to pray that there's going to be a systemic change there.
Yeah, so I want to be fair to them. If people read my book, if they get to the end, they'll see that there, in the last couple of years, there was a change on the board and the president, and I do think that some of the new people are trying to do their best to move things back to a more biblically orthodox. It's a mixed bag. We'll see. I am praying about it. My fear is I don't know that they understand just how deep the change is going to need to be, and they've given conflicting signals. But I do know that there have been some really good members of the board who are trying, and I pray that God will bless that.
I think your call to action is very important, where you talk about equipping yourselves for battle, do no harm, pray. You talk about what parents and grandparents can do, ways in which you can protect your children and your grandchildren. You emphasize how important it is for kids to learn to think critically. You talk about preparing your children for college if that's where they plan to go. You talk about what young people can do. I mean, this book has so much positive information. So it's not just cursing the darkness, but it's building a lighthouse in the midst of the gathering storm. You talk about what pastors and teachers can do. And what can Christian leaders involved in governance of organizations do? I think that's a poignant part of the book in terms of instruction, in terms of making a difference.
Yeah. Well, over the years, I've had the blessing to be able to counsel various people in board or governance positions. And so I try to distill some of the things I've learned from that and from myself being on a board of elders and, you know, working on committees and things. And I think that, you know, the high calling of whether you're a board of trustees of a Christian university or school or just on a board of elders is that you need to view that your primary goal as a Christian is not fundraising. It's not just rah-rahing everything. It's being discerning and making sure your institution follows its mission. And that there are tactics that are often used if an institution is going off kilter. There are tactics that are used to try to prevent that. And one is, oh, well, you're not the expert. Just trust us, whether we're the teachers or faculty or if it's a charismatic pastor, you know, I'm God's chosen one. There are these tactics to get the people who are called by God to hold, you know, governance ability, to get them to give that up. And so I'm trying to help encourage people called to governance that, no, it is your responsibility. And there are some things you can do. Most boards, at least Christian boards, try to run by consensus. And often there's a modified Roberts Rules of Order or something. But that gives you tremendous power that if, say, something is being pushed on you, simply raising an objection and forcing a discussion can end up changing something dramatically, because there may be other people on the board who also don't agree. But if one person speaks up and initiates a discussion, I mean, the way a lot of things in Christian institutions, in my knowledge, end up getting done is when they're swept under the rug and there isn't an open discussion among the board, let alone other people. And if you can force a discussion, then a lot of good things can come with that. But I do think that if I gave one thing, the number one thing that I think a board member of a church or a school or other parachurch ministry needs to be concerned about is the quality of the people they hire. In government, you know, I'm a political science professor, so I like government analogies, but in government, there's an old saying that personnel are policy. And in fact, whatever you think of Trump, good or negative, I think people could see a dramatic difference between Trump in his first term and Trump in his second term in hiring people who actually support his mission. Now, you may think the mission is bad, but he's hiring people who actually are willing to carry out his mission, whereas the first time he got a lot of pushback on people. And so similarly, if you have a Christian institution and you're not making sure that every faculty member, every teacher, or every pastoral staff member at a church really fulfills your mission, that's your biggest disservice, because that's where the rubber meets the road. They're the people who are called to mentor. They're the people who are teaching. They're the people who are carrying out the mission. And so you can't have people who aren't really committed. And I remember as an elder, when we had to, you know, interview people for pastoral positions, and we were considering one particular church that I was an elder of. And it was when this church was part of, I'll embarrassingly admit, was part of the PCUSA, which is a really liberal denomination. This church was not. And ultimately, we led the church out of that denomination to a more conservative one. But at this point, you know, someone wanted to be in a position, and we had a series of questions we wanted to ask to make sure that, you know, what's your belief of biblical authority? What's your belief on marriage? What's your belief on, you know, is there just one way to salvation, you know, through Jesus? And we want everyone to respond to that. And we were sort of told by some, well, no, don't ask. Just let me talk to the person and feel them out. You don't need to get written answers to these questions, or you don't need to ask them yourself. But as a board, we ended up insisting. And then that person ended up withdrawing because they didn't really fit our mission statement. But had we not insisted on specific answers to these specific questions, these weren't the be-all, end-all questions, but they were indicator questions. And if we just farmed out to someone else who wanted the person hired to just talk and report back, they might have been hired. And so, you know, the most crucial thing you could do is make sure that your staff and your workers of your Christian organization are solid. Because if they're not, it's the gift that keeps giving. And they will find thousands of ways, both consciously and unconsciously, to undercut your mission.
I have a couple more questions, and then we're going to end the podcast, although I could talk to you all day long. You know, you end your book on exactly the right note, a call to faithfulness. Give us just your summation of what that entails.
Yeah. So I think along with the inordinate celebrity culture among many American Christians is this inordinate desire for worldly success. And that plays out in many ways. It's like, well, you know, how much money are you raising as a Christian ministry? And I'm not saying these are not important, but I'm just saying it's an emphasis on worldly indicators of success, winning at all costs. Well, I'm sorry, that is not the biblical view. God is in charge of history, and he's in charge of what's going to happen. And we're not like Atlas, you know, the ancient Greek fable with the weight of the world or the heavens on our shoulders. All we're called to be is faithful. God will take care of success or non-success or what he does to be success, but we are called to be faithful, and he will find ways to bless that. And so my biggest message of that last chapter is that's what we're called to be. And I sort of get some examples where Christians are too wedded to what they think is worldly success. But then I also show just how surprising God is in being faithful, and that people should not be disheartened because, well, first of all, you know, through eternity, God prevails. But even in this life, the times when Christians have been, you know, I don't think Christians adequately know, especially American Christians, of just how many times, if you were a Christian, you probably thought Christianity was just going to be extinct and everyone was destroyed. There were no faithful people. And yet, even on the cusp of that, often God brings about a surprising change. And You saw it in the Roman Empire when there were many horrific persecutions, but then you had this turning. And I think, you know, it's a bittersweet tale because Constantine got into some bad things, but certainly the legalization of Christianity and that the right to worship was a good thing. And suddenly you had a dramatic change there. You had in early America, you know, people had this idea, oh, America was just founded as a Christian nation. Well, in some sense that was true, but in some sense it's not true. By the 1790s, a lot of Americans were imbibing the doctrines of the French Revolution, deism, the Transcendental Movement a few years after that. And so if you actually look at church attendance, and let alone church attendance at Bible-believing churches that believed in the Trinity, by the 1800, it was in New England, this was a really sad situation. Yet, what happened? There was something known as the Second Great Awakening, which was not perfect. There were some, you know, bad parts of it, but overall, there was this massive increase of people going to Bible-believing churches and the joining of Bible-believing denominations for actually joint efforts. Like they, you know, you'd have Baptists at that time, Episcopal, or, you know, Lutheran, Presbyterians would invite an evangelist to their town and jointly, you know, hold events. So by the cusp of the Civil War, church attendance, Bible reading, biblical belief shot through the roof. And so, but you had a time that was very discouraging. If you were a believer in China after the Communist Revolution, you may well have thought, well, that's the end of any, you know, Christianity there. But there are now hundreds of millions of believers in China, despite the government. And so God works in amazing, mysterious, and surprising ways. And so I think we need to trust in that and take hope, you know, that he holds the future.
Yeah, I was just in China a few weeks ago. I was in four different cities in China. I was also in Taiwan, and I can attest to the vibrance of the house church movement in particular. And I even saw in the Three Self Patriotic Movement, I saw people who were very committed to the faith once for all delivered to the saints, very committed to the propagation of the Word of God. Interesting enough that I was in a facility in Nanjing where Avery Press, they've now printed, I think this number is correct, 300 million Bibles in China. You can walk into a bookstore. I've walked into two bookstores in China and bought Bibles, authentic Bibles. I bought the NIV in Chinese and in English so you could read it both ways. So yeah, amazing what's happening there in terms of the explosive nature of the faith in the midst of persecution. I want to end this podcast, Dr. John West, your vice president, senior fellow at the Discovery Institute. I'm a big fan of the Discovery Institute. So many brilliant people there, committed, faithful Christians. And I want you to talk a little bit about the state of the intelligent design movement and, you know, this wonderful organization that's making a difference for time and for eternity.
Well, thank you. You know, it's a really exciting time. And being with this, you know, for about three decades, it's interesting that perspective, because when we got started, you know, this was the heyday, I'd say, of what became known as the New Atheists in the 2000s. So even in the 1990s, you had Richard Dawkins, you had Daniel Dennett, all these people who were saying the wave of the future is scientific materialism. Darwin is true. It's now beyond doubt. And you know, there were some faithful Christians who had been faithful all along on that, but culturally speaking, that was certainly dominant. And what we've seen, and I admit, I give credit to Steve Meyer because he's more of an optimist than I am. I am always skeptical that, you know, things are going to turn out or radical change because people, you know, like just wedded to their beliefs. But, you know, he's always talked about, you know, this cusp, that we're on the cusp of these dramatic changes. And in the last 5 years, especially, the situation has almost completely changed. I mean, we have gone from having all these cultural popular leaders who embraced Darwinian materialism and atheism to it is really hard now to find a serious person. So now I'm not talking about internet trolls like Professor Dave, who still inveighs against, you know, is a true believer in Darwin, but people like Richard Dawkins or even, you know, that quality of people, you know, Stephen Jay Gould from years ago, I mean, that caliber of people who were wrong, but were high-powered Darwinian materialists, these people have not reproduced themselves. They're not out there. I mean, we have Jerry Coyne at the University of Chicago, but he's a pale reflection of himself. I mean, Richard Dawkins is now calling himself a cultural Christian. I mean, it's just, so they haven't reproduced themselves. So on the other hand, we're having all sorts of people at the highest levels who are expressing either interest in intelligent design, mainstreaming it. And these are not all Christians. Some of these are still believe in a type of evolution, but they're willing to talk about, you know, ID and willing to treat it respectfully. And then you have the people who've just converted into something, you know, like a more teleological view, a purpose-based view of the development of life. And so I have to admit, we're in the midst of a mindset change, actually at Discovery, that I have to remind our staff, because we've been so used to being the embattled minority that we've talked like that for a long time. And this has now changed because, like I said, once Richard Dawkins calls himself a cultural Christian, he's still a Darwinist, and you can't find the high-powered people who have replaced him, things have changed. And when you have people like the Dark Horse podcast, Brett Weinstein, who isn't a Christian, doesn't support intelligent design, but doing a podcast saying that when he was in graduate school, he didn't take any of this seriously, but now that he's met Steve Meyer and his colleagues, they love science and they're raising really important questions, even though, you know, he doesn't go all the way to ID. These are objective factors of change. And, you know, let alone, you know, Thomas Nagel, let alone the guy at Yale, David Gelernter, the famous computer scientist. I mean, the number of high profile people who are now either skeptical of Darwin or at least, you know, open to conversation on design, it's just night and day. Now, does that mean that everyone's embraced intelligent design? No. You know, what they're scurrying now is to try to come up with, well, what's some new materialistic way of explaining the problem? But I think we are in a, right now, there's an open window. It's not going to last forever. And who knows what will come on the other side of it, where a lot of people on the secular side are scrambling for a replacement for atheism, atheist materialism, especially scientific atheist materialism. And so it's kind of exciting. And it does call us to change our mindset a little bit from not just being the embattled minority, but to be the common sense. Oh, here's just one little tiny microcosm that was sort of a foretaste of this larger change. Again, in the 1990s and 2000s, one of the big pieces of evidence for Darwinian evolution was so-called junk DNA. That junk DNA paradigm has been exploded. I mean, you could count on probably your fingers the number of people who still defend it, because every week, almost, new research is published about some function for the non-coding DNA. And so that was an early prediction in the 1990s of people like Bill Dembski and others, that if things were designed, you probably would expect more levels of function and you wouldn't expect massive levels of non-function. I mean, we do live in a fallen world. There are things aren't perfect. And so I'm not saying you wouldn't expect some of it, but still this idea that 90% of our genome was junk doesn't fit very well within a design paradigm. And so based on other evidence, Bill Dembski predicted in the, you know, late 1990s that we should expect to find increasing levels of function in that so-called functionalist DNA. Lo and behold, now that's mainstream. That's actually the scientific consensus now. So it's exciting.
Yeah, it is. And I appreciate you on so many different levels. Obviously, you're a scholar. You're a professor, but I like the tone of your book. I mean, what you've done is whenever you can give leeway or give credence or credibility or say something positive about someone that you're very critical of, you do that. And so I very much appreciate the tone of the book, the courage to write a book like this. It is a brilliant book. I highly recommend it. Again, Stockholm Syndrome Christianity. You know, I read it three times, so I deeply believe in this book. It is available to anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. Your copy available at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. You can also get your copy on the web at equip.org. We have made good on our promise to bring someone interesting, informative, and inspirational to the podcast once again. Dr. John West, thank you so much for your time and your expertise.
Hank, well, thank you. It's been a real privilege to be on with you.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning into this edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. If you enjoy the podcast, subscribe, rate, review. It helps a lot. Look forward to seeing you next time with more of Hank Unplugged. So long for now.